Charlie Brown is. That's right. I got a book this morning from Sandy Bullard, and she even marked a place for me. It says, it's time to cultivate inner beauty when you look in the mirror and, number one, realize that your worst enemy is gravity. Number two, discover the hair you used to have on your head now lodges in your nose and ears. Number three, notice a striking similarity between your actual face and the photo in your passport. Number four, find that your skin doesn't fit as well as it used to. Number five, decide to forego organic foods because you need all the preservatives you can get. And number six, use caulking compound to camouflage the circles under your eyes. It reminds me of that story, you know, about these two old men that were playing checkers in the nursing home. And these two old ladies, they were trying to get their attention, but no matter what they did, these guys just wouldn't pay attention to them. So these two said, I'll tell you what, let's just peel everything off and we'll streak all across the hall and in front of them. And so they shuffled along there, you know. And so one old man said, you see that? And the other one said, yeah. First one said, I don't know what they're wearing, but it sure needs ironing. Well, let's open our Bibles to Genesis chapter 9. Now, at this point in our study of the book of Genesis, the old world is gone forever. It's totally obliterated. A new world has come about, and there's a new covenant, which is a renewal of the old covenant, that has just taken place on the grounds of a sacrifice. And it's always been true, and will forever be true, that if you want to approach God, you've got to do it on the grounds of a sacrifice. You cannot do it any other way. See, that's the problem with idolatry. And the problem with all pagan religions is they want to approach God on the basis of their merits. That was the trouble with Cain. But I don't have a coin to lay on God's counter. I don't have anything. I have nothing to offer. The only thing that I have is the blood of Jesus Christ, a sacrifice on my behalf. So that was the grounds for this covenant. And in this covenant, we find out that one thing was that the animals would have the fear of man instilled in them. And the reason why is because they were on the expanded menu for human beings now. In other words, man could eat animal food now instead of just vegetable food only. So they had good reason to fear man, right? I mean, that old cow out there in the field, she knows that one of these days that she's going to be a steak on the table, right? So, therefore, they had reason to fear man. And we read how that human government was instituted for the first time. And that the fundamental law upon which human government was founded was the protection of the sanctity of human life. And that if anyone took a human life, then that life would have to be taken from them. And there was an authorized agent to do that, and that was the government. In the primitive days of this, it was the man's brother. And every murderer had a brother. And that brother was deputized to go out and apprehend that person and bring him to justice. And so, that's what government is for. That's the first and foremost thing that government is for, is to protect the lives of its citizens. And to avenge the lives of its citizens at the hands of murderers, whether it be a gang of foreign thugs or whether it be domestic murderers. That's the main reason government exists. And you know something? I was telling my wife on the way down here that we've got an old street fighter in the White House today You don't start anything with him because he'll finish it if you start anything with it. You ask about 16 or 17 people that appeared on the stage with him about that. He didn't start anything, but when he finished it. And that old guy understands one thing. He understands this principle for which human government was founded. And you know all these smart people that are around, and they're so intellectual, and they think they got it all figured out, and they think that he's nothing but a dummy. I guarantee you he's got it right, and they got it wrong.
That's right.
So at any rate, this was the law upon which the human government was founded. And then we had a signature on that covenant, which was God's rainbow. And it was to the Jews, who have a tradition that to them it was symbolic that God has taken his battle bow, in which he went to war against the whole world and destroyed the whole world in a war, in the flood. And that now, to symbolize that he's at peace with mankind and he will not ever do that again, he's going to lay his bow up on the mantle. He's going to put it hanging on the wall. And that every time he sees that bow, that's going to remind him he'll never again destroy the world with a flood. And so that's an interesting tradition that they have about that. Then we got down to verse number 18. And the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But that's exactly the reverse order, their birth order. Because they were born Japheth, Ham, and Shem, according to how they came into this world. But God reversed that order. And you know, God does that a lot. In fact, he says that when the great day comes, that many who are first shall be last, and the last shall be first. And you know, I'm glad that he said that, because I've never been anything in this life. I've always been at the end of the line on this life. But you know, he's going to say, come up to the front of the line when I get up there. Isn't that great? And so that's how that this is listed here, because Shem is the one who gave the world their God, their knowledge of the true God. So he's listed first. Now, it says, these are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. So every body today all over the earth can trace their lineage back to one of these three sons. And that's what we're going to be looking at in chapter 10. But first of all, I want you to notice, we didn't read the last part of verse 18. It says that Shem, Ham, and Japheth were the sons, and Ham is the father of Canaan. Now, keep that in mind, because for some reason, the editor of the book of Genesis, who is Moses, he wants us to pay particular attention to this man Canaan and where Canaan's going to come from. Because by the time we get to his day and time, there's going to be a war between God's people and Canaan. And so he wants you to know about Canaan. He wants you to understand where Canaan came from, what his origins were. Canaan was born after the flood. And we'll see more about him in a moment. And so Noah then began to be a husband on the north shores of Ararat, up there on the north slopes, I should say, of Ararat, up in the land of Armenia, which today is in far eastern Turkey. It's actually kind of, that mountain range is on the border of Russia and Turkey and Armenia. And so on those slopes, perhaps, Noah began to plant a vineyard, the Bible says. And now we're going to read the terrible story about how he got gloriously drunk on homemade wine.
Yeah.
Now, this goes to show you that the most righteous man of his day, one of the three most righteous persons mentioned in the Old Testament, Noah, Daniel, and Job, these names associated together, that I don't care how, the very best of us is not above taking a fall.
That's right, brother.
And we have to keep that in mind. That I don't care who you are, the Bible says that, wherefore, let him take heed that thinks he stands, lest he falls. But the thing about it, we're going to see another principle that two of the boys, his boys, are going to carry out. Galatians 6:1 says, if one of us finds a brother that is overtaken in a fault, Let him that is spiritual among you restore him. We're not to kick the person when they're down. And that's what one of the sons did. It brought out a character flaw in him. And the other two boys practiced this principle in the book of Galatians. They restored their father, but the other one kicked him while he was down. And we're going to see that this is going to factor greatly into a prophecy that Noah is going to make. He didn't cause these things, but he's going to predict what would happen in human history because of the fathers and the character of the fathers and the descendants. Now, did you know the Bible tells us in Romans chapter 14 that nobody lives to himself and nobody dies to himself? And let me add a little bit of an extrapolation to that. Nobody sins unto himself. You may think that your sin doesn't affect anybody but you, but you're dead wrong. When we sin, we don't sin without it affecting somebody else also. Those that are close to us. Those that love us. When we read how that God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai, we read that in that first commandment that the Lord said that He was a God who visited the sin of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations. What does that mean? It means that the father's sins will affect the lives of the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren. That's what it means. Now, are the children, the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren, are they accountable personally for the sins of the fathers? No. Ezekiel, God told Ezekiel, you make it clear to the people that a person is accountable for his own sins. That the father may sin and the children's teeth be set on edge, which was an illustration of how it would affect them. But the soul that sinneth, it shall die. That's personal accountability. Ezekiel made it clear the first time in the Old Testament that a person is going to stand before God and he's going to give an account of himself unto God. It's not my neighbor, not my brother, not my sister, but it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. And it's me that's going to give an account of myself. So let everyone give an account of himself unto God. So I'm not responsible for what you do. You're not responsible for what I do. I will give an account for what I am guilty of. You will give an account of what you are guilty of. But the wonderful thing about it all is that if we confess our sins now, we will not be judged for those sins later, because what God forgives now in time will be forgotten in eternity. Amen. And at the judgment seat. So I don't have to worry about those things if I come before Him daily and confess my sins. He's faithful and just to forgive me of my sins and to cleanse me of all unrighteousness. So you don't want to see those things at the judgment seat? Then you get them under the blood now. Don't wait until we have to deal with them then, because you won't go into heaven carrying that baggage with you. It's got to be dealt with now or at the judgment seat before you can sit at the marriage supper of the Lamb. Does all that make sense to you?
Amen.
All right. It makes sense to Lynn. Okay. Now, we find that Noah planted a vineyard. He began to be a husbandman, and he planted a vineyard. And he drank of the wine, and here's the first mention in the Bible of wine. And did you know that there are 15, there's 10 and there's 5, 15 words in the Bible in the original tongue that it was written in that refer to wine, and we just translate it with one generic English word, we just say wine. But there's wine, and then there's wine. There's wine that that in the dream that the butler had that was in prison with Joseph. He dreamed that he got three grapes and was crushing them into Pharaoh's cup. And Pharaoh was drinking the wine. What kind of wine is that? That's good old wholesome Welch's, isn't it? That's wine. And I believe that's the kind of wine that Jesus used at the Last Supper. Now, you've got to recall that, and the Jews claim, You know, that the Passover is to be celebrated with, and they use alcoholic wine. But they didn't observe the Passover from Joshua's day all the way down to Josiah's day. And Hezekiah's, there were hundreds of years they didn't observe it. I mean, just didn't observe it at all. And so when they finally did come back and observe it, somehow they lost that truth. But what is it that makes that Welch's ferment? If you leave it out on the counter and you leave it long enough, day after day, week after week, what will happen to it? There's something in the air that will cause it to ferment. You know what that is? It's yeast. There are yeast in the air, and it will cause fruit juices to ferment. Now, yeast in the Bible is called what? It's called leaven, right? Okay? Now, what were the Jews supposed to do before they ever prepared the Passover meal and sat down to observe the Passover? They were to search their houses and make sure there was no what in their houses? No leaven. And that's why they had to cook their bread without yeast, unleavened bread. Now, does it make sense to you that God would be so meticulous about not having leaven in their bread and then allow them to have it in their juice? No. If leaven represented evil and that which is sinful, and all that had to be gotten rid of before they sat down to observe the Passover, and out of the elements of the Passover the Lord instituted the supper, then it makes absolute sense that it would have been unleavened wine as well as it would have been unleavened bread. So I'm just giving you some stuff here that's why we use fruit of the vine. That's why Jesus says, I will not drink this fruit of the vine until I do it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. Okay, so there's wine and then there's wine. There's the kind that Solomon wrote about in Proverbs chapter 20 and says, look not on the wine when it's red, when it gives its color in the cup. He says it will cause men to do strange things. They'll think that they can lie down on the water. That they can walk on the water. Big Jack McGoy was an old East Texas Baptist preacher, but he was rough as a cob before he got saved. And you know, sometimes he would revert. You have to watch him. My pastor wouldn't have him. I heard him one time in our church. He was a little afraid to let him take the pulpit. You never know what Jack was going to say. Old Big Jack was talking about somebody. He was preaching in his church. He said, he pointed his finger out there and he says, so-and-so, you know, they crossed him up. He said, you do that again, I'm going to whoop H out of you. He said, right out there, you know, in the... And he told that. Everybody's head stood up, you know. But you never knew what Jack was going to say. But Big Jack was telling a story about in his days before he was saved, that he was down on the Sabine River, and they were fishing all night. And there was an old man named Uncle Bill down there. He said, I never knew what his last name was. Everybody just called him Uncle Bill. And Uncle Bill was drunker than a skunk. And Uncle Bill got up and said, well, by golly, said, if Jesus can walk on the water, so can Uncle Bill. And he walked off down into the river. Like to drown. They fished him out of there. And so old Jack said, what's the matter, Uncle Bill? I thought you said if Jesus could walk on the water, you could walk on the water. He said, yeah, but Jesus wasn't drunk like Uncle Bill. So there's wine and there's wine, right? Moral of the story. So Noah got gloriously drunk. And then he got hot, all inflamed with the wine, and he threw his cloak off, and he lay uncovered, naked in his father's or in his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan. Now notice again, we have the association, the father of Canaan. Now Canaan is going to be the people that God is going to have a holy war with in Joshua's time. They're going to have to be exterminated. There's some people that get so deep in sin, they're like a cancer in humanity, and they need to be cut out. And I mean, to give you a perfect illustration of that, ISIS, they need to be cut out, don't you think? They're a cancer in humanity. I mean, they have forfeited their right to live in God's eyes, and God will use a human sword to do that. And he used the human sword of Israel to take care of Canaan later, but Moses is giving us some background information, and to his readers 400 years later, as to making the case as to why that the children of Israel were going to have to be delivered from Egypt and go back into the promised land and cut that cancer out of the promised land. He's making this case. This is part of what this is all about. You've got to read the greater context. So Ham is the father of Canaan, and saw the nakedness of his father, and told his two brethren without. Now the Jews, some of them, believe that Canaan may have gone in first and came and told his father Ham, and then Ham didn't do the right thing. Ham, you'll see as we go along, had a little bit of rebellion in him against his father's leadership. Ham wanted to be the ruler of the family. The old man's getting old. He's 600 years old. And Ham wanted to be he wanted to take over the headship of the family. There's no doubt in my mind, reading between the lines, between this and what follows, that was the thing with him. And Ham was the one, through Canaan, his son, that led the world into idolatry. That's why we're going to be reading what we're reading here, so keep this in mind. And so he went and told his two brethren without. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward and they saw not their father's nakedness. This is one of the most noble acts in human history, showing piety toward a parent. Even when the parent had fallen into sin, yet these boys showed a noble spirit. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. He probably woke up and wondered, why am I all covered up like this? And then he began to ask around, and then he began to find out what the story was. And when he awoke, he knew, and he said, he began to speak. The prophetic impulse came upon Noah, and Noah began to speak a word of prophecy. And it's the first recorded prophecy we have in the Bible. It's not the first oral prophecy we have. We had a verbal prophecy that came from the lips of Enoch. It doesn't record it in Genesis, but we're told in the book of Jude that he was a preacher and a prophet and prophesied about the coming of the Lord with his tens of thousands of saints. So he was a verbal prophet. Here we have the prophecy recorded, and here's what it is. Noah is going to look out over the horizon of time. He's going to look out over the history of the world, and he's going to tell us the developments of the descendants of these sons and how along the lines that they're going to go. Now he said, cursed be Canaan. Specifically, he names Canaan. It's not Ham that he's naming Canaan. He said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Now, did this apply to the other descendants of Ham? Possibly, because we don't see any blessing that's recorded, but specifically, we have a curse against Canaan, and this would be literally fulfilled in the days of Moses and Joshua, when they would go in and they'd either wipe out the descendants of Canaan or they would make servants of them. There was one group of Canaanites called the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites, you know, there were all sorts of ites back in those days. There was the Gibeonites, the Jebusites, the Girgashites, the Termites, and all the rest. And so the Gibeonites, they were the ones that knew that the children of Israel were going to destroy them if they didn't do something. If they put on old clothes and disguised themselves and got moldy bread in their baggage, and they said, we're ambassadors from a far country, and we want to make a treaty of peace with you. And they didn't disclose who they really were. And without consulting God, Joshua and the elders of Israel made a covenant, made a league with them. And then later, when they found out, they were just over the next hill, and they were part of the group that was to be destroyed on their way to destroying the Canaanites of the Promised Land. Then they could not go back on their covenant, because a covenant was a sacred thing. You did not want to be known as a covenant breaker in the ancient world. And so they said, all right, we won't kill this people, but we will make them hewers of wood and drawers of water. And so to the very day that Moses wrote, they chopped wood and they brought up water for the children of Israel. And they were protected. They were a protected people, a nation within a nation. Now later, Saul, King Saul, violated that covenant when he went out and he killed some of those people. And because of that, there had to be a day of reckoning, and David had to make things right, and he had to go out and take some of the sons of Saul and kill them and hang them up before the Lord in order to make that right, to right that wrong that had been done for Saul breaking that covenant. This is all stuff that if we ever get into 1 and 2 Samuel, we'll go into that then, okay? So, this is the story about Canaan. He would be a servant of servants. He would not be, and frankly, because Ham did not receive a blessing, he would not be the dominant ethnic group on earth. As far as, and yet, we're going to find that as we read along, that he's going to try to break that. He's going to try to defeat that. Do you remember Ahab? And I'm not talking about the Arab. But I'm talking about King Ahab, the husband of Jezebel. King Ahab was told by the prophet Micaiah that you're going to die, you're going to be with me about this time tomorrow. They were going out to fight the enemy, Syrians. And you recall that Ahab was going to defeat that prophecy. And so he made a good buddy out of the southern king, Jehoshaphat. And Jehoshaphat really had got himself in deeper than he should have. He had a rebuke from Elisha, the prophet, told those two kings of Israel, you shut your mouth. He said, I wouldn't even talk to you if it wasn't the fact that good King Jehoshaphat's with you. And then he asked Jehoshaphat, why should you help the righteous? Why should the righteous help the wicked? What are you doing with these people? You're running with the wrong crowd. Well, Jehoshaphat, he was a little soft in the head. Had a little soft heart. He went down to Ahab to call him his brother and to see if they could patch things up because, you know, the kingdom had been split for several years, several decades. So Ahab says, I'll use this gullible old King Jehoshaphat. Said, I tell you what. Said, they're going to be gunning for me tomorrow. And that prophet Micaiah, I've got him on bread and water. I hate him. He never says anything good about me. Well, it's because he never did anything good. But at any rate, he says, you wear my robes and you get in my chariot. And we'll meet this prophecy. Well, Jehoshaphat didn't tell him the whole story. So he gets out there and he's got on the garb of the king of Israel, the northern king. And he's in that chariot. And so the general, Ben-Hadad, had told all of his sub-generals, you concentrate on the king. We nail him, knock him out. Then all the rest of them will scatter. It's kind of like in the old Cowboys and Indians show, you know. You get the chief and all the Indians will take off, right? So they all begin to focus on Jehoshaphat and he began to cry out. He began to cry out to God, Lord, help me. And so soon they recognized that this wasn't the real king of Israel. This was just a disguise. And it says that one man took a bow, and just let it fly, just at a venture, it says. In other words, he didn't even aim. He just took that arrow and just let it fly. One time I was a kid, and I had a bow and arrow. And I told my next-door neighbor, I said, I'm going to see how high I can shoot this thing. And so I said, you better get out of the way. And he didn't move, and he wasn't moving very fast. I said, you better run, because I'm going to shoot this thing. So he runs over and gets under a sweet gum tree. That arrow comes right down through the middle of that sweet gum tree and lands about 3 feet from it. And man, I heard a big noise over there. And I said, I told you, you should have run. He was up against that tree with his hands like this. Well, that's what this guy did. But you know, let me tell you something. When God says something's going to happen, he had Ahab's name on that arrow. And that arrow hit Ahab. And he had a suit of armor on. It wasn't like the English wore, but it was armor. But that armor you tie it up, and it had a joint in it. And wouldn't you know that it hit him right between the joint, right in the joint. And he fell down into his chariot wounded. And they took him out of the fight. They took him back to Jezreel. And he died in Jezreel. And when they washed the blood out of his chariot, the dogs licked up his blood according to the word of the prophet. It took 20 years later to get Jezebel, but they ate Jezebel too. They threw her down from a window. And, it's like that old preacher, that boy that was all mixed up, and he was saying, and they said, throw her down. And they throwed her down. He said, throw her down some more. And they throw her down some more. And after 70 times, seven times, of the fragments, they picked up 12 baskets full. That is some stuff all mixed up. Now, what about Shem? Verse 26, Ham is going to try to defeat this, and frankly, he's going to be... The first three world empires were Hamitic empires. They were the leaders in migration. They were the explorers of the world. They were the leaders in technology. Shem and Japheth would come along later and use the technology that Ham had developed. And we're going to see these people were basically a super race in the early days, but that all comes a little bit later. Now, it says, blessed be the Lord God of Shem. It would be through Shem that the world would receive the revelation of the true God of heaven. And said, and Canaan shall be his servant. And then verse 27 says, God shall enlarge Japheth. He's going to have the greater amount of territory. And he would be the one that would be the most skillful at governing, at governance. And this will be how it's all going to develop. And he says, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem. That means that he's going to get his knowledge of the true God from Shem, through whom came Abraham, through whom came Jesus Christ. And Canaan shall be his servant. And Noah lived, after the flood, 350 years. And all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Now, there's some similarity between Noah and between Adam. First of all, both Noah and Adam were heads of a new race. Adam was head of the original race. Noah was head of the race that would come after him. Both of them, they sinned by partaking of fruit, didn't they? One, the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The other would be the fruit of the vine. And both of them, each of them became naked, didn't they? God was walking in the cool of the day and said, Adam, where are you? I'm hiding. What are you hiding for? Because I was naked. How did you know? And then we, of course, read about the account of Noah. And both of them were provided a covering by somebody else. Adam received his covering from God when the little animals were skinned, and he put the coats on Adam and Eve. Noah received a covering by someone else, and that was his two sons, Shem and Japheth. And then their sons were affected by a curse and by a blessing. Abel was blessed. Cain was cursed. Canaan was cursed. Shem and Japheth were blessed. So this is the story of the life of Noah, and it says, verse 1 of chapter 10, now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were sons born after the flood. That's the key signature that signs off and completes the book on transitions between the book of the sons of Noah and now the new book of Shem. This is the book of Shem that we're about to get into, and chapter 10 is one of the most unique documents in all the world, because this is the table of the nations. When you would later read in prophecy about certain nations, you go back to the table of nations and you find out who they are, where they came from, what part of the world they occupied geographically, and that helps you interpret prophecy. And the Jews could go to this and see who their neighbors were and who was going to be. And let's read just a little bit. There's certain motifs in this table. We'll read the sons of. We'll read he begets. And we'll read these kinds of motifs. By the way, this table, and you can look at this little chart that I put out here. I happened to find this yesterday or the day before. And so I thought, well, I'll reproduce this and let you have this. Now, this tells us how the whole world was overspread from the sons of Noah. And then I'll tell you what the bottom part of the chart means in just a moment. But first of all, we have the sons of Japheth, named first. Then we have the sons of Ham. And then we have the sons of Shem. And these are in the birth order. Now, this is a horizontal table. By that, I mean that I'm going to take a horizontal line, and we've got the descendants of these three boys basically in a horizontal line. It doesn't go very deep. The genealogy in chapter 5 and the one in chapter 11 are vertical genealogies. They start at the top and go way on down until they get several generations deep. But this one is a horizontal genealogy. This is a table of 70 nations, just as there were 70 souls that went down into Egypt with Jacob. There were 70 nations that the world was divided into. And by the way, in the book of Acts chapter 17, God set the boundaries of these nations and determined beforehand where they should dwell geographically, and they were not to get out of their areas. And you know the first thing that would happen? The descendants of Ham would leave their assigned territory, and they would try to take the territory of Shem and try to take the territory of Japheth. They were going to be the dominant tribe. They were not going to be the undominant tribe, which is what Noah said they would be. They were going to defeat the curse. Well, let's read a little bit. The sons of Japheth, he's the elder. Now, first one, his name is Gomer. U.S. Marines, private first class. No, this is not Gomer Pyle. This was Gomer. And Gomer had a brother named Magog. And Magog had one named Madea. And then they had one named Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. Now, it's out of Gomer. Have you ever heard of the Celtic people? These were the Gauls that Julius Caesar defeated in France. And the remnant of them fled to the British Isles. And what's left of them today are in Wales and in Ireland. And there's a little mixing and marrying with the Scottish. These are the Celtic people. They were a great nation back at one time. But they were defeated in the Roman days. All right, and Gomer had a brother named Magog. Magog is the father of the Slavic peoples. Do you know who the Slavic peoples are? They are the Romanians. They are the Russians. Now, the Russians have intermarried somewhat with the Mongolians because the Mongolian hordes from the east, wave after wave, would come in and they would get as far as the Russian steppes. And some of them got as far as Hungary. The Hungarians were the Huns. Okay? At any rate, that's who were the descendants of Magog. And that's important to us in prophecy. Medea, he was the father of the Medes. Do you remember who the Medes were? The Medes hooked up with the Persians, and later they would have the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay, Darius was the Mede in Daniel chapter 6. Cyrus was the Persian. Then we read about Javan. Javan was the father of the Greeks and the father of the Romans. Those were the tribes that would settle around the northern part of the Mediterranean. And then Tubal and Meshech would settle close to Magog. And some believe that the name Tobolsk and Moscow has been memorialized from these names. And then we have Tyrus, which would be the father of the Thracians, which would be north of Greece. And so, therefore, we have these people that would settle in these regions, and this is basically who they are. You can kind of see these in your chart, and you can write down, if you want to, the name of these names that are associated with, I've just given you the peoples in the top of that chart. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, the lands that were washed by the shores of the Mediterranean. These primarily were where they originally dwelled. Now, verse 6 says, and the sons of Ham, Cush, and old Cush got around. And by the way, Ham got around. He was over all the earth. You go all the way to Spain and you've heard of the Basque. They were originally a Hamitic people. You go all the way to the Far East, the Chinese. Ham's name is memorialized in, it was called Cham, C-H-A-M, over there. and Cambodia. Cambodia memorializes the name of Ham. These peoples, and then many of the American Indians who later would cross the Bering Strait around 2000, about 2,000 years ago is what I'm trying to say, about the time of Christ or a little before, those would have come from Ham. Cush was the ringleader in this rebellion. He's going to have a son that we'll read about here in a moment by the name of Nimrod. And this is going to be an important... This guy is a very famous name over in the Middle East from antiquity. And he's the one that founded Babylon. He's the one that took over Nineveh in the early first empire to be founded. Mizraim, he's the father of the Egyptians. In the book of Psalms, you read about the Egyptians being the land of Ham. P-H-U-T, foot. Oh, foot. Foot was the father of the Libyans. And then Canaan, he was the father of the nations that occupied the Holy Land. And the sons of Cush, we read about them, Seba, Havilah, Saba, so forth, all those names. Cush occupied a region that went all the way from India and then migrated to Iraq, and that's where his son Nimrod set up the first kingdom. And then he went down into the Arabian Peninsula, left his names on all those towns in southern Arabia, and then on down across the Red Sea and over into the other side of the Red Sea, and later his name would be known and associated with Ethiopia. So this is Cush. And we read about Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. That term mighty one is the same word that was translated giants in Genesis chapter 6. And they call this Nimrod the giant. He was a mighty hunter, a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. As the waters of the flood receded, the mighty hunter came on the scene. And wherefore it said, there was an old proverb, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And that doesn't mean that he was in submission before the Lord. That means he was in rebellion before the Lord. He placed himself ahead of the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, and the land of Shinar. And out of that land went forth Asher, who was a son of Shem, and built in Nineveh the city Rehoboth and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. We're going to come back to that in our next lesson on Genesis. And then we read about the tribes that Mizraim begat. We don't know much about these, Ludum, Anamim. We do know about Casluzim, because out of him came the Philistines and Captorum, which was the island of Crete. And as the waters of the ice age, the waters begin to rise, as the ice caps begin to melt, then it set the whole world in motion, and many of the waters out of the Mediterranean were getting covered up, and they fled. The land was shrinking, but it was becoming overpopulated. They fled, and part of them came to Egypt, and part of them came to the southeast corner of the Promised Land, and later became known as the Philistines, okay? So that's where we'll run into them again later. And then we read Canaan begets Sidon. Sidon is where the name Poseidon comes from, and Poseidon was later called Neptune, the father of the sea. These people in mythology all came originally from real human beings. And his firstborn was Sidon, and then he had another one by the name of Heth. Heth was the father of the Hittites. The Hittites were defeated. What was left fled to the Far East, and we believe that possibly they are the progenitors of the Chinese. And then the Jebusite, they were the original inhabitants of Jerusalem. The Amorites, they were the ones that settled northern Canaan. And the Hivites, these were the ones that were part of the Canaanites. And in the land, the Arkites, the Sinites. Sinites, the name Sin, S-I-N-I-M, Sinim. It's where it means the Far East, China. So that shows that the descendants here of Canaan, Canaan, that they left their name not only in the Middle East at Mount Sinai and in the wilderness of Sin, but then their name appears over in the Far East as well, which gives us reason to believe that old legend is true, that the Hittites, the remnant of them that escaped the sword, fled to the Far East. And then...
Yes, sir. Question?
Go ahead.
You know, in this area that you're speaking to,
yep.
the Jebusites,
yep.
were they giant people?
Jebusites weren't mentioned as being giants, but the ones down below them, the ones from Hebron, they were sons of Anak. They were giants. But the Jebusites were not told that they were giants. They just sat up there in their walls, and when the rest of the country got all conquered, they remained there, safe behind their walls until David's time. And David offered a prize to the one who would take that city, and Joab, his nephew, scaled the wall, and they broke through, and that's how they took Jerusalem. All that's in 1 Samuel.
Yep.
2 Samuel.
For the fortress speaks to the attitude of mankind.
What's that? The fortress, yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly. It's in rebellion against God. But it became the city of God. And we're about to move our embassy there. Isn't that amazing? Now, we go on and we read about the rest of the sons of the Canaanites, where their borders was. It even gives us their geographical borders. From Sidon to Gerar to Gaza, Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboiim, Elisha. These are the sons of Ham after their families and tongues. And Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. Eber, you put an H in front of that. What does that say? Heber, the father of the Hebrews. He is the son of Shem and the brother of Japheth the elder. Sons were born to him. Elam, they later got absorbed into the Persians. Asher, he was the one that founded Assyria and Nineveh. Arphaxad, this was going to be the father of the chosen line. Lud would be Lydia in Asia Minor, and Aram would be Syria. So we have all these, and by the way, Eber had two sons. One's name was Peleg, and the other's name was Joktan. Now, Peleg was famous because in his day, the earth was divided. Now, there's two possibilities. Does that mean that the continents broke apart? In Genesis 1:9, it does indicate that when God separated the seas from the land was all one mass. And maybe there was a proto-continent. But I think that that's not what was meant here. This would have been in the days when chapter 11 happens and the Tower of Babel occurs and the nations were separated by language, linguistically. So this would be Joktan. He became the father of what's known as the pure Arabs. The Arabs have two streams that they come from. One are the pure Arabs. These would be the ones dwelling in Yemen, the ones dwelling on the eastern side of the Arabian Peninsula. And then there's the mixed Arabs, because Ishmael had a Jewish father, Abraham, and an Egyptian mother, Hagar. So he had mixed blood of both Shem and Ham, and he would be a wild man. Boy, hadn't that prophecy been carried out. He would have his hand against every man. And that's the story of Ishmael, and he populated the middle and western part of the Arabian Peninsula. So Joktan, we'll talk about that later. When I get to Ishmael, I'll carry you through a whole history of the Arab nations, all right? All the way down to the millennium. But we'll save that for another time. Now, I'm going to close with this. This is what your chart's about. When you go to Ezekiel's chapters 38 and 39, and I'm going to take just a moment to touch on this. We read about several nations that are going to invade the Middle East, and particularly the land of Israel, as soon as God's people are raptured out of this world. That's going to set some things in motion. And the first thing that's going to happen is an invasion. And notice in chapter 38, verse number 2, Gog and the land of Magog. We go back to our table to see who Magog is. Who is Magog? He is the son of Japheth. And we know him to be the progenitor of the Slavic nations, and in particular, the land of Russia. So Russia is going to invade, and who's going to be with him, allied with him? Verse 5, Persia, that's Medea, that's his brother. Ethiopia, that's Cush, that's the son of Ham. Libya, that's Put, that's the son of Ham. Gomer, that's going to be the people that originally dwelled around Georgia, which I'm not talking about Georgia over, you know, southern part of the United States, and Cornpone and all that stuff, but I'm talking about Georgia in Russia. And all his bands in the house of Togarma. This would probably refer to the people that originally settled in the area of Armenia and Turkey. And then all his bands, that would be the central today, what is the Central Asian Islamic Republics. All of these will be aligned with Russia at the head coming down to invade the land of Israel as soon as the Christians are out of here. Don't turn your back on Putin. Don't trust him any further than you can throw him. Because the Russians are not going to be the friend of Israel. They never have been. They never will be. Okay? Now, we read actually that there's two circles of nations. There's an outer ring and an inner ring around Israel. And that's true today. The inner ring would be Lebanon and Syria. And then there'd be Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt. The outer ring would be Turkey and Iran, Libya, and Persia, by the way, is modern-day Iran. So, you see how the table of nations can help you understand prophecy. When we go to the book of Daniel, chapter 2, and we read about that giant image, and how there'd be four world empires that would be from Daniel's day to the end of time. First, there'd be the Babylonian, the new Babylonian empire. Second, there would be the Medo-Persian empire. Third, there'd be the Grecian empire. And fourth, there would be the Roman empire. And fifth, there would be a revived Roman empire, because the image's feet were part of iron and part of clay. They would be partly strong, partly broken. And you know, our democracy in the United States today most resembles the form of government that the Romans had, and there's a weakness and there's a strength in a democracy. We're seeing the weakness in it right now, the divisions, all of this kind of thing. But there's also a strength in democracy because we don't have an autocrat that is ruling over us. When we go to Daniel chapter 7 and we read about those four beasts in the dream of Daniel, then once again we have those four empires. That last one had great iron teeth, and he broke everything in his path. Then we read in Daniel chapter 11 about a king of the north and a king of the south. Much of it was history that was fulfilled before Jesus' time. But we skip then to the end, we jump a big gap in time, and we read about one that would arise out of the king of the, he would be the king of the north. He would arise out of that, it would be the king of the south, and that these eventually are going to come against the Antichrist and his army. We go over to Revelation chapter 13, we read about a beast out of the sea. And then we read about how that beast had had all the characteristics of the four animals that Daniel saw in his visions. And then we go over to Revelation chapter 16, and we read about kings of the east. And then we go to chapter 17, and we read about how that there were six world empires. And then there's a seventh, and then the eighth comes out of the seventh. That goes back all the way and names two before Daniel's time, which was the Egyptian and the Assyrian world empires. And then we have, once again, the four that I named. And then we have the last one, which will be the revived Roman Empire. And then, out of that, would arise the Antichrist. So putting all this together, this table helps us understand and get a clear picture of what's going to happen. There's going to be, at the end of the tribulation period, there's going to be an invasion of Israel after the Russia thing has been defeated by God, and five-sixths of them, you can read this in chapter 38-39 of Ezekiel, five-sixths of that army is going to be wiped out and destroyed. It'll take them 7 months to bury the dead. And then, as we go into the tribulation, then this Antichrist will arise. He'll have the solution for all the world's problems. He'll represent himself to be a benign individual. He goes forth on a white horse with a bow, but he doesn't have any arrows. He's conquering, but doing it peacefully, through peaceful means. But then, in the middle of the tribulation period, he will reveal who he really is and show himself for who he really is. And then, as we progress through all the plagues of Revelation, we come toward the end of it, we find that he invades the glorious land, sets his temple up, sets his headquarters up at the temple, the rebuilt temple, breaks his covenant with Israel, persecutes Israel to the ends of the earth, and then we read that he would have destroyed Egypt as he sweeps down through, but tidings out of the north and the east cause him to turn back to meet those challenges in the land of Palestine. There'll be the kings coming from the east. The Euphrates will be dried up. There'll be a 200 million man army coming from the east. That would be the Chinese, the Orientals coming. There'll be the kings from the north. which will be what's left up there of Syria and those lands up there. There'll be what's left of those lands to the south, which will be Egypt and her allies. And he's from the west. He's heading the nations of the west. He would be representing the European nations and probably the United States in alliance with the European nations. And then when those four armies converge in a flame called Armageddon, suddenly there'll be a fifth army that'll appear. It'll start out as a little point of light, but it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger until it's evident it's the Lord of glory with all his saints and angels behind it. You see how this table can help you go from the back of the book, front of the book, to the back of the book. You understand that? Okay, my time is long gone, so I'm going to get back to here.